And I told the last... All right, I guess I'll bring the meeting to order. It's a larger crowd than I'm used to, but we're here. I guess we're...
Let's make sure everybody's signed in.
We need to have everybody sign in, just the planning department, and I would like to know who's been here or who is here. Apparently, we have someone here from a public access television station that's filming us. I guess it's a public meeting. I have asked that he get permission before he broadcasts anybody his image, and he has told me that he doesn't need to do that because it's a public meeting. So
that's not exactly how you phrased the question.
All right.
You didn't ask about people's images. You asked about the fact whether I could film or not, or videotape or not, that I needed to get permission.
Okay, then can you clarify?
My understanding, if I can just explain, my understanding of open meetings law is that these sorts of meetings can be recorded by the public.
Okay, and all I was going to tell everyone here is that make sure your ties are tied, knotted correctly, and that you look good. I mean, the first thing I generally do is go around and do introductions. However, I think at the size of this meeting today, if I do that, we'll be here until 3 o'clock just introducing everyone. As I think those of you who have been coming to these for, have been to several of these know, I try to address various issues at each monthly meeting or bi-monthly meeting. I try to bring in someone who's an expert in the field or someone from the regulatory agency. Today, because pipeline has been an issue and a subject of a lot of conversation, I've invited Jim Austin down from the PSC, and he's going to address pipeline regulation, pipeline oversight, the PSC's role, FERC's role, which is someplace where I find that there is a great deal of confusion, is the difference between our PSC and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And I'm going to turn it over to Jim. When we're done, we're going to go briefly over some of the education issues that we've been working on, efforts of the Chamber of Commerce with the directory, which is pretty much completed, and I'll open the floor up for questions.
Mr. Moderator, just wondering if we could do this. I'm wondering if we could just see who's here representing what counties. Could we do a show of hands? Just to see who we have here?
Sure. Jim, I have no issue with that, certainly.
Can Chenango you County?
Chenango County, raise your hand. Broome County?
I'm from there.
Okay. Otsego County? Delaware County?
I'm on phone.
And Madison County?
Outstanding. Thank you.
And anyone from other counties?
Thank you.
Very good. Well, I'll turn it over to you.
With that, good afternoon. Thank you for having me. My name is Jim Austin, and I'm with the Department of Public Service. And DPS is the staff to the Public Service Commission. Public Service Commission is 5 members appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate, and they're charged with overseeing basically anything that's regulated utility, be it telephone, communication, natural gas, and electric primarily. Steve gave me a call, asked me to come down and talk about the Article 7 process and how we regulate pipelines. I've got a brief presentation. I've done this about a billion times, so I'll probably skip around on it because we also regulate Article 7 covers natural gas pipelines. It also covers electric transmission lines. And so I'll skip the part unless people are interested on electric transmission. Article 7 was, it's Article 7 of the Public Service Law of the State of New York. It was enacted by the state legislature in 1970 to establish basically one-stop permitting for pipelines and electric transmission. As you can imagine, pipelines and electric lines cross many, many towns, many counties, numerous elected governments, and permitting them at each individual location proved to be unwieldy. So the legislature enacted Article 7, providing one-stop shopping. We issue every permit required by state or local governments, any state or local government. We don't override federal authority. So if you have to get a federal permit, you still have to get that. Anything else required by a town or a state entity, a state Department of Environmental Conservation, Ag and Markets, State Historic Preservation Office, we issue all those permits. They all come as part of our certificate. The Article 7 process for local governments is the applicant has to say that they find a local law unduly restrictive, and then the commission has to make a finding that it is indeed unduly restrictive, and then that law can be waived. Usually the things you see for those findings are local zoning, fees, things like that. But it really doesn't happen that much anymore. The pipeline companies tend to work fairly early with the local governments, find out what they need and what they want. So by the time they come to us, you don't really see them asking for any waivers anymore. An applicant has to get something called a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, a CPCN, under Article 7. And that includes an awful lot of things. It includes an environmental review. There's different levels of findings we have to make for different levels of pipelines, different size. And I'll get into that in a second. The legislative intent was to provide a single forum through an open process to resolve all matters of interest to the state. It includes citizen and interest groups, municipalities, and state agencies. And one thing I should point out, I think most of you probably heard the phrase SEQR, State Environmental Quality Review Act. Article 7 projects are not subject to SEQR. It's one of the few state practices that is exempt from SEQR. Having said that, the process we undergo is substantially identical to SEQR. We do the same kind of, I'm going to use the phrase, hard look. Environmental impacts have to be identified, and they have to be mitigated to the greatest extent possible. It does require an environmental analysis. It requires impact minimization, and there is a full public participation process. Purpose of Article 7, legislation called for new facility siting procedures to minimize environmental impacts, and this is straight from the law, such as forest clearing, streams, wetlands and habitats, land use conflicts, agricultural land disturbances, historic resources, quality of life issues, such as impacts on construction, traffic, dust, and operating effects such as electromagnetic fields, visual impacts, and noise. And it provides a forum for the resolution of those issues. As I mentioned before, Article 7 covers electric lines, 125 kilovolts or more, and 1 mile or longer, or 100 kilovolts, kV or more, and 10 miles or longer. I won't get into the pipe, the transmission too much, electric transmission, excuse me, unless people are interested in it. As far as gas lines, we cover all pipelines 1,000 feet or more, up to a minimum, it has to be above 125 pounds per square inch. And the reason we don't go below that is because we'd then be looking at all the lines connecting pipelines to people's homes and businesses, and that's a matter of local franchise. There are exceptions in the law. A pipeline located entirely in a state or municipal highway or street, located entirely underground in a city, or replacing an existing facility and is less than a mile long. So those are the exemptions to Article 7 pipelines. Our application requirements are in regulation. The legislature passes a law, then the agency issues regulations with the fine details. And in this case, it's the regulations are 16 New York Codes, Rules, Regs, Part 85. And all these rules, in fact, the statute, the law, and the regulations, I'm going to mention a few regulations, are on our website. So if you just go to our main webpage, you'll see a little, it's a site map, and then regulations or statutes, so you can find them all there. The filing requirements include facility location, and we require maps and aerial photographs, a description of the facility, and that includes everything connected to the facility. So the term in the law is appurtenance, but it basically means anything connected to it. So a compressor station, a regulating station, a place where you'd inject a cleaning pig, all those things are considered appurtenances, and so they're all subject to the law. A description of the need to build and operate, the environmental impact assessment, construction operation and maintenance, and a comparison of reasonable alternatives. Now, the alternatives requirement is only for the highest level. Again, I'll get into the three levels in a second. The applicant is also required to file a notification to all local governments that are involved, all the municipalities, be it town, city, and county. They have to notify the state legislators, the assembly, and the senator where the line would cross, and quite often that could be a number of them. All affected state agencies. As a rule, that's our agency, Department of Environmental Conservation, Department of Agriculture and Markets, and the State Historic Preservation Office, which is part of the Office of Parks, Recs, and Historic Preservation. Those are the ones we normally deal with. And they also have to file a copy of the application at all local libraries. We now put that on our webpage as well. It's a lot easier to access this stuff over the web. We have three levels of pipeline, a small, medium, and large, and then there's a fourth, and that's an interstate. No, thank you. That's a interstate pipeline involved in interstate commerce. And those are dealt exclusively with by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and I guess I'll talk about that in a second as well. But the three levels are all found in, they're described in Article 7, and it's Section 121A of Article 7. And just by way of background, that was enacted, I want to say, 1981, I'm sorry. And it was in response to companies complaining to the legislature that the Public Service Commission took too long to process pipelines. That we had a one-size-fit-all mentality, so the largest pipelines down to the smallest gathering lines were all held to the same level of review. So the legislature, in its wisdom, created this three-tiered system, and the smallest level has the briefest review, the medium has a medium, and obviously the full-blown Article 7 is a full-on review with no time limits. The smallest level is 121A2 of our public service law, and we call that a notice of intention, or an NOI. And basically these are the small gathering lines. The line's 1,000 feet to under 5 miles long and 6 inches or less in diameter. And the law requires that upon receipt of a complete application, my department has 30 days to review and issue a notice, a certificate, for those pipelines. If we don't act within those 30 days, the pipeline is deemed approved. So the legislature created a very short timeline for us to act on these smaller lines. We've gotten pretty good at working with the gas companies so that when they come in, they know what we want. We also have the option of rejecting a pipeline, just saying no. So it's not carte blanche, but we do have a very tight timeline to deal with them. The second level is what we call an application. So the first is notice of intent, an NOI. The second is an application. That's under 121A3. And that's gas lines 5 to 10 miles in length and above 125 PSI again. And we're required to act on that within 60 days, or again, it's deemed complete. Now, there is a safety valve for the A3s, the applications, wherein any person in the state of New York can request a hearing. And if the commission deems that a hearing is necessary, that 60-day window is waived. We no longer have to issue a certificate within 60 days. If anyone asks for a public statement hearing and the commission finds it necessary, I think many of you are probably familiar with the recent Nor New Line. It's not too far from here. That was an A3. Normally, we would have had to act on that in 60 days. A public statement hearing was requested, and two were held. And we're still working on it. So the 60-day clock obviously didn't apply there. So what I'm raising this because if there's a lot of interest in a line and people want a more thorough process, the law does give us the ability to do that if someone raises their hand. So we can't do it without someone asking for it. So any person can do it. You don't have to be, it doesn't have to be running across your yard or through your property or in your neighbor's yard. Anyone can ask for it. And then the final level is what we call full-blown Article 7. And that's above 10 miles long. And again, it's above 6 inches, 10 miles along, and above 125 PSI. That has no requirements whatsoever for timetable. And we always hold public statement hearings, and quite often we hold evidentiary hearings where there's parties, people ask to be parties, an administrative law judge is assigned, and then the parties try to reach a settlement where all the parties sign off on the proposed line and the mitigation measures. If we don't get a settlement, then it goes into basically a trial phase where people file testimony. There's rebuttal testimony. The judge actually takes witnesses. Cross-examination goes on. And at the end of that process, the judge will issue what's called a recommended decision. And that's basically his decision. The parties can then comment on the recommended decision. And there's another round on that. And then the recommended decision would go to the Public Service Commission. And the commission can either approve, reject, or approve with modifications. So they don't have to accept the recommended decision of the administrative law judge. Some of the filing requirements, a notice of intent, again, that's the lowest level, is just served on municipalities. An application, the medium level, has to be served on the municipalities, environmental departments of environmental conservation, ag and markets, and any other person or entity that the commission deems appropriate. The full-blown Article 7 process, I just talked about it. It's docketed, an administrative law judge is assigned, and then public service staff is assigned as well. There's what's called a trial team. And the team generally consists of engineers, environmental specialists, economists, legal counsel, we have consumer outreach people, and then the administrative law judge and hearing examiners. On the bigger cases, there can be several judges assigned instead of just one. For instance, the NIRI transmission line had three judges on it, to give you an idea. I just talked about that. We have after an application is filed, this is a full-blown process. We have 14 days to review that for completeness. And then we have to, the secretary of the commission will issue what's called a notice of completeness to the applicant. That starts a clock. Our SCAS safety provisions, and I can talk about that in a minute as well, are in our regulations. And that's 16 New York Codes, Rules, Regs, Part 255. I'm not a gas safety expert, but I do have some background in it, so I hope I can answer any questions you have. But all our requirements are in that regulation, Part 255. Parties to an Article 7 proceeding, as I said, those agencies that are always parties, DEC, Secretary of State, Ag and Markets, Parks, and then Public Service staff, and then obviously the applicant, and then anyone else can ask for party status. And there's two levels of party status, one's formal, the other's informal. An informal party member basically just asked to be notified of all documents. You get a copy. It used to be mailed. Now it's electronic. You get a copy of all documents filed, and you get notice for all the any meetings associated with it where the parties are meeting. And obviously the public are invited to those as well. But an informal party member gets notice of it, and as I said, they get all the documents. A formal party member gets all that. But they also, I was talking before about trying to reach settlement. And then a formal party member has both the privilege and the responsibility to work with the other parties to try and reach settlement. A formal party member is subject to the order of the judge. So if the judge says, you will have documents to me by this date, you better have them. So there are obligations that go with formal party status as well. So I generally, with a private citizen, unless you're a line is proposed to go across your land, we normally recommend informal party status for people that are just interested in the process. But there's nothing precluding people from going, you know, the full bore and becoming formal party members, just with the understanding that you have obligations as well as privileges that go with that. What we just talked about, informal versus formal. I talked briefly about this, but in a full-blown Article 7, the first phase would be an evidentiary phase. The applicant presents his case. Other parties files basically testimony, and then there's rebuttal where people say, I think these facts are wrong. That goes back and forth. And then the judge will find basically all matters of fact that everyone agrees on, and then they'll set aside the ones that aren't agreed on to be discussed in the trial phase. Briefing phase is just summarizing evidence and arguments. The decision phase, an ALJ, I talked about this before, will issue a recommended decision. All the parties reply to that. You say, I agree with it, I don't agree, or I agree with all of it except this little section. And then the ALJ can modify that or not, and then it goes to the commission, and they have to act on it within 30 days. And as I said, they can approve, reject, or approve with modifications. Trying to think what I haven't covered. We talked before about those three levels, the NOIs, the applications, and the full-blown Article 7. The phase on top of that is a pipeline engaged in interstate transport, and that can be any of those. It's whatever, basically, it has to cross a state boundary, although a pipeline connected, building a new section that's connected to an interstate pipeline can throw you into that. And then FERC has to deem that it's necessary for interstate commerce is what it comes down to. Generally, what will happen is if there's a question of whether or not it's a FERC line or a state line, the applicant will write a letter to FERC asking for a determination. Nine times out of ten, if it's a gathering line, connecting a well to a trunk line, FERC will say that's not our business. I can give you an example of that. We've got one in front of us called Laser Midstream right now. It's only just under 10 miles in New York, and then there's another section in Pennsylvania, and it's connecting fields in the Marcellus play in Pennsylvania to the Millennium Pipeline in New York. Because it's connected to an interstate pipeline and because it's crossing state boundaries, FERC could have said this line's involved in interstate commerce. They wrote a letter back to the applicant saying, nope, it's a gathering line. Pennsylvania deals with the Pennsylvania portion of it. New York deals with the New York portion of it, and we're in the process of doing that. That came in at 9.8 miles as designed, so it's a 121A3, what we call an application. We did have a 60-day clock running for it, but someone asked for a public statement hearing, and they said we held a couple of those, and we haven't issued anything on Laser yet either. So that the clock really does stop when we go into that phase. I guess rather than me just blabbing on more, I'd be more curious if I can answer any of your questions, if there's something you'd like specifically covered. Sir?
Yes, it's Jim, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Jim, in Smyrna, and I know Steve is here from Norse, and so they can weigh in too if I don't get this right, but I understand the three levels that you've explained here. But in Smyrna, in my town, I know that we've gone through some very sensitive environmental areas.
Mm-hmm.
We've put pipeline in, and I believe there were probably lines below 125 PSI.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, how did the legislature reconcile that kind of fast-tracking of a pipeline through a sensitive area, whether it's 125, 20 pounds, or 500?
Well,
I mean, the same environmental degradation is happening. It struck me as very unusual. Frankly, it didn't make me very happy to find Norse going through a very sensitive area.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it had some kind of review,
Not at the public service. If it's under 125 PSI, it didn't have a review at the Public Service Commission level.
What about DEC?
DEC, anytime you're going to cross a wetland, a listed wetland, or disturb, I think it was 5 acres, it's down to 1 acre, construction disturbance of 1 acre or more, you trip what's called a stormwater protection plan under the Clean Water Act. So that's regardless of whether or not it's a Article 7 line or not. They have a map of listed wetlands. There's federal and state wetlands, and there's different levels of requirements for both. And then, as I said, you get the stormwater protection requirements of SPDES, State Pollution Discharge Elimination System, for those, regardless of what size of line it is, if it's the construction is disturbing more than 1 acre.
Okay, and I want to give Norris an opportunity to respond to this. I'm specifically speaking, Steve, of the Cole Road wetlands on both sides of the road there.
Mm-hmm.
I was frankly surprised they could even get through there. It's that kind of wetland. I mean, it's a bog. And it's fairly sizable. But I'm just, it seemed to, I mean, if what you're saying is it appears that, I'm not sure where the oversight came from.
Well, there'd be DEC, again, if those thresholds are met. I can't speak for what the legislature's intent was in 1980 when they did, 71 and then 81 when they modified Article 7. I can say it would probably be counterproductive to have us involved in reviewing connecting pipelines to homes. And mm-hmm. I think that was probably
understood.
Their intent.
Okay.
In drawing at 125 PSI. Local zoning isn't waived at that point. So local ordinances all apply. And as I said, if you cross those thresholds, I can say from our perspective, if there's a wetland or a stream, we normally require a directional bore instead of a cofferdam's a cut in a trench. If you're going through a sensitive area, the pipeline companies we work with, by and large, look at the same maps we do. I know Norris does, so that when they're looking at a proposed route, they're knowing their life is going to be a lot easier if they avoid sensitive areas.
Yeah.
I can't speak to that specific case because I don't know it.
I don't know, Steve, if you wanted to comment.
Yeah, generally, Dennis does most of our permitting here, so help me out if I'm wrong here. But what we would generally do is work with the DEC. We do the RP and we do
the
DEC.
Can
we louder, please?
I'm sorry. Yes, we would work with the DEC and on that particular case. And we'd also, so we'd have our SWAPs and our SPDES. But we'd also do an RP, generally do RP notification also. So we kind of, even though it isn't under the PSC, we still do it kind of under the DEC, I guess you may say.
You know, and I would just end my comment saying that that seems a little out of balance to me, given that a farmer can drop one piece of manure in a stream and get fined incredibly, where this pipeline goes through a very sensitive area for quite some distance. Again, this is not an indictment of Norris, because I think you've done quite well. But in terms of oversight, I don't think it's there. I'm not sure it's there at all, and I'm surprised they didn't get buried, frankly. I never thought you could get through there.
Yeah, that's where the Division of Waters would come in and do the inspections at that point.
Thank you.
I'm not looking to expand our workload, but I mean, obviously, you go to your state assemblyman and senator, and you could obviously suggest it. You think there should be more oversight on smaller lines.
Thank you, Jim.
I don't have enough staff for what I have for the work we have, but sir.
Jim, I think you kind of answered that question, but we're doing exactly that. We being New York Farm Bureau. We have policy to support that the PSC monitor all lines, regardless of pressure, and recognizing the fact that, you know, with a minor word change, obviously, you know, you don't need the access line from the residential, certainly that wouldn't be included in that, as well as all these lines being under DigSafe New York. And as our supervisor here is pointing out, that these issues not only are an issue with the towns, because if you have a new town road superintendent, that particular line isn't designated, he may be digging a trench right where that line is. And secondly, you know, if you have a farm transfer of property Grandpa didn't remember to tell us whoever. You know, you've got some major issues here of health and safety. And so, therefore, in recognizing it's a legislative issue, we actually have legislators now that are drafting legislation that will address this, and we hopefully it'll pass.
Well, sir, I can tell you that the commission, when they issue an order, they place requirements on the applicant called ordering clauses saying you will do this. And two things, regardless of what level, the small, medium, or large, we always include as ordering clauses are, one, they'll participate in DigSafe, mm-hmm. and two, they'll file with us as-built drawings. Because you occasionally get minor variations from as designed, as built, you know, the route's off by a couple of feet. So for those, exactly what you were talking about, we always require that as an ordering clause that the applicant be part of DigSafe.
And I guess I kind of referenced Pete. I don't know whether you want to talk about that, but I think we ran some tests here, and some of them failed in the...
Yeah, who monitors your DigSafe compliance?
Well, monitors
what sense of it? In the sense that, you know, I'm sure that the intention is there to be able to call DigSafe and find one. We went one for three, which, you know, is a concern, and maybe you guys are going to catch up on that.
Well, again, are we talking about lines?
It's good for Major League Baseball, not for us.
Peter, what size lines?
Gathering lines. Actually, where we took this were three county road crossings.
Okay,
now the gathering lines have been an issue for our committee right along, and Brad has outlined a number of the concerns, which are, where are they? And at this point we know, because it's pretty new, but as personnel changes and as the farmer from here sells to somebody from there and he gets his Kubota backhoe out there and starts digging a pond or something, we don't want him to find these gathering lines. The other question is, when you talk about length, you mentioned miles and pressure. Now, what could a gathering line be 20 miles long and under 125 PSI and escape your scrutiny?
Yes.
That seems to be the case.
Well, that's the law, sir.
Okay.
It's our authority is specified in Article 7, and I can...
So the scrutiny of the long gathering line, as it were, is pretty much voluntary. The compliance,
as far as I can only speak to the Public Service Commission and the Department of Public Service, but it's a local. It becomes a local zoning issue. It's a local law. We don't overrule anything. We don't. Nothing is waived as a result of those smaller lines. So they have to comply with all local requirements. I don't know what to tell you. Our authority is what our authority is. And
well, what have other places done that have drilling? What have other localities done? We're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. If we want to know where they were, and there's issues under discussion about confidentiality and that sort of thing, which we don't quite see eye to eye on at this point, but would you say local ordinances?
I can't speak for what your local governments require. I can only speak to Article 7 and our pipelines.
Right.
But I would think you'd have the authority to say, if you want a permit to build this thing in my town, this is what you have to give me. Or your locally elected officials could pass an ordinance requiring that. But I'm not an attorney, sir, so I...
that's okay. I just wondered...
I'm straying weight off my...
are you aware of any ordinances that are in play now for gathering lines?
No, sir, I'm not.
You're not?
No. By way of background, I spent 15 years in the Department of Environmental Conservation. My background is all environmental. I do certification and compliance. My office is the Office of Energy Efficiency and Environment. We are the office within the Department of Public Service responsible for reviewing these lines. We're also, I'm sure you guys all know the Stroobs, John and Corey. Mm-hmm. They're two colleagues of mine. I think very highly of them. They're our field presence, and they're in my shop. So I'm not an attorney. I'm not a gas safety person. We do have an office of gas safety. And I spent an hour with them yesterday trying to bone up on this just in case we got gas safety questions. But my background is all environmental.
One of the questions Peter did just have was the under, you know, the location of these lines, there's a lot of controversy about whether we can know that, whether it's Homeland Security doesn't want us to know. Maybe you can address that piece since...
I received an email warning me about what questions I could expect, and the first one was that. And, and I spent some time with a gentleman named John Sennett, who's the director of our Office of Homeland Security. Now, there's an office in our agency, and there is also a state agency. So John is the head of our agency Office of Homeland Security. And his response was, there is nothing, and I'm quoting almost verbatim, there's nothing, we have no authority to overrule a local emergency management coordinator as to what information they do or do not give out. Having said that, and again, this is paraphrasing John, John sees nothing inherent about a gathering system that would subject it to the critical infrastructure criteria of Homeland Security requirements, i.e., there's a state and a federal critical infrastructure requirement that we had to identify all these things, saying that they pose threats if someone wanted to take them out. John doesn't think gathering lines, it's not the opinion of our director, the gathering lines rise to that level. They aren't critical infrastructure, is his opinion. Sir?
And as they, and once again, I know you're not an attorney, but going into other laws of the state of New York, real estate law in particular, requiring disclosure, full disclosure upon the sale of the property, how is that accomplished if these lines are
again,
confidential?
Again, caveat. I'm
not
an attorney.
Not your department.
I would think that any deed that had an agreement with a pipeline company to place a pipeline on that property would have an easement on that property that would the deed would have to identify. So I think, one, that would be in your local records office, because I spent a lot of time on right-of-way maintenance, tree trimming along electric transmission lines. Mm-hmm. And I've looked at an awful lot of deeds with easements saying, you know, this transmission company has the right to do whatever they want to your trees. And the landowner, when he buys that property, that is on the deed that he buys, and he should be reading that fine print. So,
I should be.
No.
One further question on your ordering of. You say you ordered. I believe that's the
ordering
term.
Clause.
Ordering clause.
Yes, sir.
What's the effect of an ordering clause in the case of insisting on being part of DigSafe?
Well, and there's two obligations in DigSafe. There's the information going into the database, and then there's the person with the backhoe calling it before he digs.
Right.
We don't have any control over that ladder at all.
I guess that wasn't really what I was asking about. My question is, if you have an ordering clause that says you must join DigSafe, mm-hmm. does anybody look to see whether somebody's joined?
Don't know off the top of my head, sir, but I can find out.
Okay, thank you.
I'll leave a business card for you. And
sure. And that is Peter Flanagan. He's a supervisor of the town of Preston, just so.
Okay, sir.
Maybe that's, I will ask as you ask questions that you identify who you are. Ross?
Yeah, Ross Iannell, supervisor down in Berlin. I just had two things I just wanted to get cleared up. You had mentioned during your presentation there about road crossings, that you go out on road crossings. Is that for all lines or just certain size drains?
Okay, there we go. I'm sorry, sir. Could you be a little?
Yeah, you had mentioned that in your oversight that you go out on road crossings or you check road crossings. Is that just for certain size lines or is that on all lines? I didn't understand that.
I don't recall saying that. We do put people out in the field during construction, if that's what you mean.
Yeah.
And you know, there's. I have a very, very limited staff, so they're not there 100% of the time.
Well, I'm not counting your staff, but I didn't understand that. That's why.
I think what he said was that they have control over lines that run completely underneath.
Oh, gotcha. Yes.
Right. Different.
What I was saying is what there are exemptions to Article 7, uh-huh. where a pipeline wouldn't be subject to our. Thank you. I appreciate it. Let me find the. It was lines completely under highways are not subject
oh, okay.
to our authority, is what I was trying to say.
Okay.
Just trying to find the exact language so I don't. Okay, exemptions to Article 7, located entirely in a state or municipal highway or street. So under the roadway.
Okay.
We're not subject to, we don't regulate that. Okay. Located entirely underground in a city and replace an existing facility in less than a mile. Those are exemptions to our, you're not subject to us.
Okay, thanks. Just one other question on this. When you're talking about zoning for local laws,
mm-hmm.
does the law say zoning, or were you just using that as a term?
I use it as an example.
But you don't have to have zoning in place.
No, the as I said, Article 7 is intended as one-stop shopping, and we can waive rules that the commission, or we, the commission can rule waives a rule. Can I start again?
Yeah.
The commission can waive requirements they find they deem unnecessarily restrictive. So, and for in order for that to happen, the applicant has to come in and say, "I think this law requiring X that my people not smoke while they're crossing the street is unnecessarily restrictive." If they don't do that, then all those local requirements are deemed to be in place.
Well, my question was, so you don't need zoning to pass that local law? Because most towns in this area don't have zoning. And you were using the term zoning. So
oh, no, I was using that as an example.
I didn't know whether the law said that or what.
So we recently started requiring, in 121A3s, requiring the applicant to come in with a list of all applicable local laws. This is a, our council came up with this. Prior to that, we only asked them to come in with laws they wanted waived. They still have to specifically say, "I think this law is unnecessarily restrictive. Would you please waive the requirement?" Otherwise, as I said, the requirements deemed to be in place.
So then it's your opinion that the locality can pass laws pertaining to gathering lines?
Again, with the caveat that I'm not a lawyer, New York's a home rule state, sir. To the extent that you're not preempted by Article 7, local governments have a lot of power in New York. Okay. Article 9 of the Constitution?
Yeah. I had a question.
Sir?
A question on your response there. When one comes and says the law is too restrictive, is there then some kind of a hearing where the town can appear and assist that it's not?
That would be in the application, and it would be part of the process. So there's not a specific hearing exactly for that. In an A3, if you ask for a public statement hearing, one, I can't think of a reason why the commission wouldn't grant that. So the application would say, "I think this requirement," again, normally it's zoning, but "I think this requirement is unnecessarily restrictive." That would be part of the application.
Right.
So when we're doing the public statement hearings for that, the commission would have to make a finding that that particular requirement is unnecessarily restrictive.
But that finding would include communication with the town that passed this.
Oh, yes, sir, absolutely.
So that's what it might
yes.
be. It just wouldn't be done in a silent back room somewhere.
Hopefully not. No, sir. The commission is very, very public. I mean, all our actions are...
Yes.
Sir?
Scott Pickbaum from Clint Siegel County Soil and Water. You mentioned ag and markets a few times.
Mm-hmm.
They have guidelines for remediation of fields after the pipelines have been put in place. To account for things like hydrology, mixing of subsurface soils with topsoils and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're a formal partner, I guess, in these larger full-blown Article 7.
Yes, sir. They actually put people in the field.
That's what I'm getting at. Are they also involved in the two smaller categories? At what point do they promulgate their guidelines so that the contractors in the fields who are doing the work know that this, that, and the other should be done so that in the end the farmer's getting the same productivity out of it?
I know they're involved in A3s. I'm not positive about A2s. But I will tell you, we have something called Environmental Management and Construction, EM and CP and S, Construction Practices and Standards. Environmental Management, Construction Practices and Standards. And we require all applicants either to accept that they'll use ours or to provide us with theirs that we then have to review and approve. And those construction practices and standards have things in it about you got to be 60 inches down below a plowed field. If there's certain hydrology, you got to tile it when you're done. There has to be soil erosion. You want to keep the soil there. So our construction practices do include very, very specific requirements about how you build the line to avoid those things. Ag and Markets does have to sign. I know they have to sign off on A3s. I'm not positive about A2, sir.
Can I ask one other question? On the A3 and the public statement hearing, you said anybody could ask for that or request that. How would one know that a pipeline is being proposed so that they might do that?
Well, there is a requirement that the pipeline company notify certain, all the agencies, all the state assemblyman, the state senator. So hopefully, and it's been my experience with the pipeline companies that we deal with in New York, that they tend to go to the locals and let them know that they're going to be out there, certainly in larger lines. Quite often you'll see it in, we have a requirement that it be published in a newspaper of local circulation. But once that process is started, all the documents are available on our website. Maybe that's actually an excellent point, just to get into how you can get information from our website. We have a thing called Document Matters and Management and Matters. Document Matters Management. DMM. Document Matters Management. It's on our webpage, and that's dps.state.ny.us. And DMM, if you know the case number, or if you know the name of the company or the name of the line, you can type that into DMM, and every single document, every meeting, everything is on that webpage for every single case we handle. So the application, a petition to the Secretary of the Commission for a public statement hearing, that would be up there. The petition, the commission's finding on whether or not to have it, that would be up there. All the documents I talked about briefs on accept, well, the stuff that's in, when they're in settlement, the parties keep some things confidential until the ALJ rules. So not all the documents in a settlement or a litigated case are on, but as soon as the ALJ rules, they're all on. So there is that exception. But I do encourage you to avail yourself of it because it's really a wealth of information. Sir?
Yeah, Jim, before we get away from this gathering line issue, and I think that's, you can see that's quite a focus here, the concerns that Peter raised and others have raised here are real. We obviously, we don't want a farmer or rural resident to dig into one of these lines, whether it's, you know, low pressure or high pressure. When I turned to Norris and asked the depth of these lines, I was initially told 4 feet. Then I was told 2 to 4 feet. It doesn't sound like, although you may have a 5 foot, you said 60 inch, recommended.
Well, no, that was for ag land, sir. The 60 inches is usually for land, for some that's going
to
be tilled.
But again, is this similar to the situation before where there's really no oversight? Is anyone there watching them put the line in from a regulatory agency?
On lines that we regulate, yes, sir.
Gathering lines?
Well, again, on lines that we regulate, above 125 PSI.
These are gathering lines. They're specific to gathering lines. Is anyone making sure that they're down where they should be?
So the reason I keep coming back to this is there are gathering lines above and below 125 PSI. So above that we regulate, I don't have a lot of staff, but my guys are out there.
All below in Smyrna, all below 125, then they vary between 2 and 4 feet.
All I can speak for is my agency, sir, and we don't have the authority to do it. If my guys were in the field telling them you can't dig that there, and they pointed out it was below 125 PSI, we'd be done.
Got it. Well, so, I understand. Thank you.
Oh, sure. I'm not trying to be.
No, I know you're not. I appreciate it.
We appreciate your time. The questions just keep coming up, and this is why I do this.
So,
I agree, Jim. It appears that
please, can you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry, Roger Bradstreet from the town of Nelson, Madison County, okay. And also the chairperson for Natural Gas Work Group in our county. It appears that you don't have the answer, but it appears that there's multiple people concerned about less than 1,000 feet and pipelines that are less than 125 pounds per square inch. And is there anybody sitting in this room that knows who tells us where those pipelines are and records them?
I can answer. That would be us. Just the natural responsibility of the company to know where your pipelines are. Here again, when we put them in, even the gathering lines, we pretty much follow some of the PSC practices here again.
pipeline goes in, caution tape goes on top, and you've got tracer wire for your location of it, and then we map it, and so it is in our system.
Is
as far as the one calls go, yes, we get our all of it. I don't believe under regulations that gathering lines are required to be in the one call system, last I knew. We, as a company, do that just as a precaution for our own lines. I want to make sure everybody's aware of that. And there are some people, I'm sure, that aren't tagged into the system yet. They will be.
I hope so.
Is Norse subject to open records law?
I'm sorry?
Is Norse subject to open records law? Can the public ask for that information?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Are you with Norse?
Yes, I am.
So you can't answer whether I can get that information or not. You can't tell me.
No.
This is not pertinent to this discussion.
If you have a question, you're more than happy to get in my card, and we'll get you the answer. So,
I'm sorry, Steve.
I don't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to jump in before I forget. I've been at that age. To go on with the conversation, I'll
nobody
forget.
Nobody ever stopped you, Pete.
Thanks, Ross. Good to see you, too. You said earlier, and I wrote it down right after ordering clause, that part of the, and I believe it was in relation to what we're referring to as gathering lines or lines below 125, that you required as-built drawings. So it sounds like you've got the map.
No, sir. There wouldn't. Again, we don't regulate lines under 125 PSI, so there wouldn't be an order, so there wouldn't be ordering clause for that. When I was speaking that, I was referring to the lines we actually do regulate.
Okay, so they still have to file a notice of intent, the lowest.
Well, application, a notice of intent is the lowest. It's the 121A2.
And that does not include, at some point in time, an as-built drawing.
Well, we do require as-built drawings. For A2s.
Not A3s.
Well, no, sir. An A2 is 6 inches
right.
And above 125 PSI. So if it's below those two thresholds, it's not an A2.
Okay.
So and that's our lowest level of...
Okay. That was my question. I misunderstood it.
I'm sorry.
Trying to figure out the answer. You don't have the maps either.
No, sir.
The only person that has them is the company.
Okay. There's a lot of... question, most of our lines, I'm Steve Guys with Norse, there's a lot of questions on lines under 125. Most of our systems up here are gathering. Could you maybe cover a little bit with the PSC, the safety, you know, our notifications of 48-hour notifications before we put the lines in, and, you know, we're still under the safety auspices as far as the
On the lines we regulate?
No, these would be under gathering lines.
Well, our pipeline safety people do lines we regulate. They do FERC lines as basically agents of USDOT. Mm-hmm. And apparently they also do gathering lines. I wasn't aware of that. I'm not a gas safety person.
Just the safety division does.
Yeah, a gentleman named Gavin Nicoletti is our head of gas safety.
Right.
He gave me some notes on the stuff that we do regulate, but we didn't talk about the below 125. So I apologize. I'm not qualified.
There's a 48-hour notice that the company needs to give the PSC prior to, and then the safety inspector came from off. He can cut your welds out and make sure that first off your safety is all in place for the pipeline itself. Then each of the fusers needs to be certified also. And he'll check their credentials. And then also has the option of cutting certain sections of the pipe that's been fused off and do a longitudinal cut on it just to check to make sure that the welds are the specs. So,
again, not my shop, but I can hook you up with them if people have questions.
Perhaps we need to do that and have those people come back, someone from that division come down, because that is honestly... probably the biggest issue that I keep coming up with here is who controls the gathering lines. The second thing that seems to keep coming up is that you guys seem to be developing something that I would refer to as a best practice, that the impression that I'm given is that does not apply to the entire industry. You as a company are performing at a level above what is required.
In some cases, yes.
And, you know, in fact, if that's the case, it may be something that should be addressed with that division and perhaps we could come up with some kind of a legislative action to incorporate your the best practices within the industry into the regulatory structure. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get discussion. Good one to have, because that seems to apply more to the areas that we're working in.
Right, and that's going to be
larger Article 7.
And that's going to be the majority of the pipeline that's built over the, you know, over the next 25 years will be low pressure gathering line. I mean, that's just how this business works. It's how the business works. I got three hands over there. John, you've had your hand up, I know, multiple times.
Because it's probably a foolish question. The pipeline that Norris is presently instructing that will run through my town, John Coventry, what class pipeline is that? Is that an A2, an A3, an Article 7?
Is he talking about the A3, or? I'm not sure which line you're talking
What's
about.
What's the one that goes through your town, Pete?
I think that's referred to as a gathering line less than 125. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Plastic, yes.
Plastic line is it?
Yes.
So that's headed
your way, as I understand it.
It's heading my way, and I'm just trying to figure out what it is. So that's an unregulated gathering line.
I have to look at my notes.
By his division of the PSC.
Not by him.
It won't be regulated by Jim's division of the PSC, but the safety.
The safety
division has oversight over that.
And then also the DEC, as we talked before, with the SWEPs and all of the, you know, the archaeological and the wetlands, all that.
Well, if I'm hearing correctly, then if a town had a site plan review law in place, then that particular pipeline would also have to comply with site plan review law for disturbances of soil or other things. Mm-hmm. If it's unregulated by these guys, then it would be regulated by local law. Okay. And when you do a review for a pipeline such as this, are we talking pipeline where it's one pipeline, or is it a right-of-way where you can put more than one pipeline under that same review?
Well, it's for transmission lines. For the big lines, I'm talking about Columbia Millennium. You know, Millennium used a good chunk of the Columbia's right-of-way. You need to go from supply to demand, obviously, so a gathering line, by definition, is going from a well to a trunk line. And so using existing corridors is always available for that, because the well may not be in an existing corridor. I guess is all I'm trying to say. To the extent, I know electric transmission and major gas lines, if there's an existing corridor and it fits the need to get it to move it from A to B, we certainly, because that's going to minimize the impact. And we're required to do that to the greatest extent possible.
So it would be a separate review if a second pipeline was to be put in on the same right-of-way track.
Well, it's again, not an attorney, but it's pretty complicated, because the pipeline company and the existing right-of-way has an agreement with the landowners. It may not include additional lines. You've got to reach agreements with all those landowners. You have to reach an agreement with the owner of the current line. And then it has to also line up with, does it move it from where it is to where it's needed? If all those things can happen, then we'd absolutely encourage using existing right-of-ways. But there's a lot to happen. Do you see what I'm trying to say?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
I probably didn't answer very well.
No, I got it.
I'll go left to right, if that's all right. Yeah, go ahead.
Rob DeClue from Chenango County Soil and Water Conservation District. I arrived late, so pardon me if you've already addressed this, but
speak up, Rob.
On the threshold for pressure threshold, mm-hmm. we're regulating that 125 psi. Is that a design or an operating pressure?
Well, they're not allowed. The pipelines are frequently built to more than what they're. It's operating. If they were to go to 126 psi, and we were to find out about it. There are many pipelines out there that are built to a higher operating pressure than they're allowed to operate. If it's built to 4,000 psi and they say, don't worry about it, we're running it at 124, and we find out they're running it at 150, we go after them with enforcement that it's that they should have had a certificate.
So my interpretation is that operating pressure that the applicant...
Yes, sir. I can give you a case in point. There's a small gas utility, Corning, They built a system at under the threshold, under 124 PSI. The system was designed to be operated up to 4,000, and they decided they wanted to operate it above that 125 threshold. They had to come in and get a certificate. So if it doesn't matter what it's built to, is if it's operating above that, they have to come in.
Thank you.
Sir?
Yeah, try not to speak from ignorance, but here goes anyway.
Please don't answer
yourself. All right, and what Rob said, this may have something to do with it. The vocabulary escapes me, but I need some. How are these lines, and I think I heard the word fused, together? So to complement the 125 or 127, or what, how are they fused? How is that done? What's the procedure in construction? How is it done?
Do you want a description?
Yes.
I think I can give that to you, unless one of you guys want to jump in, but let me stand up. The PVC lines, the plastic lines, they bring those in, two pieces of pipe. They have a machine that clamps the two pieces of pipe. There's a cutter that looks to me like a large disc off a food processor with multiple blades, carbide. They cut the two pieces of pipe square to one another. They heat those on a hot plate type of apparatus, and they push them together, and it actually melts the plastic is melted and it fuses. I have a sample of that down in my truck if you'd like to look at it.
Is that that is almost a weld?
In fact, it's a plastic weld, yes.
Yeah. Depending on the size of the pipe, that's where the requirements will come in, on the amount of time that you put the heat on. As Steve said, when those two pieces come together to that plate, we'll have that plate heated to a certain temperature according to what size pipe you're working with in the pair. And then you'll also have a time that you actually put both of those, after they heat it up and take the pad off, put those two together now. Depending on the size of the pipe, that'll have a different time for compression, we'll say, to get that fuse to work. So like a 2-inch piece of pipe may take only 2 minutes, we'll say. And a 12-inch piece of pipe might take 5 minutes. So there's varying. That's where it's important to make sure that you have certified fusers, which is part of the process.
And they go through some kind of educational procedure?
Yes, they do, yes. And they actually get certified to weld, to fuse that plastic pipe together.
They'll actually fuse sections. They cut samples. They do tensile yield tests on them to certify the process.
And the people doing it have to be certified.
And the people that are doing it have to be certified.
So we had a couple here and then here.
Yeah.
Jennifer? Just a quick question. Back to the last item you were talking about. I wasn't really clear. You said, it's the operating PSI that designates what level the pipeline is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you find out that they go above that, then they're in trouble. How would you find out? Who's monitoring it that would tell you that now we're at 126, but yesterday we were at 124?
Now, I'm not expert on this, but I understand you do have to keep records of your pipeline pressures.
Yeah, there's two things going on, because we monitor the pressures on an hourly basis, basically, with the well tenders. Mm-hmm. We also have charts, and on those charts, they dictate what that line pressure is and what your differential pressure is. Because it's important for us to know that also, because if the well tender's at the far end of the field and he sees the line pressure went down to 20 pounds or went up to 100 pounds, there's a problem with that system or one of the wells.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows that he has to go out and find out where that problem is. So I guess it would be incumbent upon us with our records.
And then if a DC staff person or who else looks at your logbooks, would then maybe see if there was a change or, does anyone else other than the company know?
Well,
I'm trying to wrap my head around how.
No, I don't think that there's anybody that monitors the actual pipeline pressure. holding ourselves and having it on record.
I see where you're going, and I'll ask our gas safety people if they check these records. So.
I think we're going to bring somebody in from your gas safety, if that's all right. You can warn them what this is like. You know,
oh, absolutely.
You know, we do provide snacks and cold water, but you know, the pressure is always on.
I just want to point out,
I was going to say, this gentleman's been waiting patiently, but...
Okay, I just had a quick follow-up, kind of a point. You know, from an economic standpoint, I mean, these people seem like very nice gentlemen over here, but if this company has, or any company under regulation, has an economic advantage to escape the regulation by keeping their pipelines, like, you know, under some kind of limit.
Well, we'll bring in the safeties division and see how they do that.
Besides just the safety point, you know, if they have an economic incentive, you know, it sounds like they might have an economic incentive to, you know, with all due respect, you know, not keep honest records if they're escaping state regulation or state taxes or something.
You know,
like that. So I just want to clarify too. There seems like there's a lot of people involved in the government in this room that we have to keep in mind that the duty of the government is to really watch what's going on.
Yes.
And it sounds like this is not being done so well. There's not really. It's like, oh, you know, the company keeps the records. Yeah.
Well, can I comment on that? Uh-huh. Because we do keep the records. There is quite a bit of exposure if we go over whatever those laws may be.
Your records are not subject to public inspection.
They could be.
They could be subject to...
The SEC could come in. The gentleman could come in, ask for our records, and we would have to give them.
By law, your records are not subject presently to open records. In fact, I have tried to get, you know, plenty of corporate records, and they were denied. It's hard to get state records sometimes.
This gentleman has his hand up for patient.
In your experience, it's obviously a safety question. Which is more durable or long-lasting, the plastic or the steel?
Well, we require steel for anything, you know. I mean, obviously, the coated steel is what we get for the higher-pressure lines. I can't speak to the durability below. I mean, maybe this gentleman can. And again, you know, it sounds like Gavin's going to be taking a field trip down here, so maybe he can speak to it. But I can't believe they'd allow them, for the pressures it's being operated, to use the PVC if it wasn't durable and safe. I mean, there's a lot of 100-year-old iron pipeline out there and distribution systems.
As long as it's been maintained and the iron holds up. But the PVC is covered by a number of ASTM specs.
And polyethylene,
I'm sorry, polyethylene. My bad on that. But the polyethylene is covered by a number of ASTM specs, and longevity at the low pressures is probably more than adequate, I will say.
Well, not only that, but the advantages with the plastic over steel, corrosion, plastic has not. Earth movement, is there any change in the ground at all, across, or whatever, you get it underneath the plastic. There's any movement, so there's some advantages to having the plastic. Plus, you can get it in certain sizes at a longer length, so it'll require fewer fuses. Whereas if you had steel, you're 30 or 40 or 50 foot that you have to do all the.
I'm sorry. Yes. Sorry, from the side of my eye.
I was wondering, recently the Millennium Pipeline sprang a leak.
Yes.
Was that, how did you find out about that? And was it reported by the gas company, or what happened?
I found out about it in the newspaper.
Yeah,
our pipeline safety people knew about it. The company notified them. This is federal line. It's subject to, FERC certifies it. USDOT is responsible for operation, and they have requirements. But we are basically USDOT's contractor in New York State. Our people have to be trained to their levels, and we send them to, I think it's in Texas somewhere, you probably know, there's a pipeline safety class that they have to be trained to, and there's a requirement that they notify us. Now, again, this is a federal line. This is a line involved in interstate commerce. So therefore, it's USDOT's, not the Public Service Commission's requirements.
But your safety people, you said, do the inspections on the FERC lines?
Yes.
So
we're basically the federal USDOT's contractors on this.
Right. So you get informed, but at that stage, the gas doesn't smell at all, does it? So the people walking by wouldn't notice.
Well, there's an odor requirement.
Where does the odor requirement start?
That I don't know.
Do you know?
Do you know if there's an odor requirement in Millennium?
In
interstate transport. The big lines, the 36 to 24 is the... I don't know where you're supposed to inject the mercury.
I don't know what all the requirements are for the different companies. There are generally requirements for
you don't
distribution.
Know, right? Well, I was just wondering, the Millennium Pipeline is obviously a really big one, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure. I know that gas doesn't smell, so you have to add the mercury. But if mercury hasn't been added yet, then people walking by can be gassed, right, without knowing, because they wouldn't smell it. It would be like silent poisoning.
There is, to speak personal opinion, there is an odor to gas, to the natural gas.
But not what you're used to. It doesn't smell like it does in your kitchen.
Yes, and the reason that they do that is they put that mercaptan into the distribution systems, in particular, just for that reason.
Yeah, but that's the distribution system. That's not the interstate system, is it? Or the gathering system isn't? Or
mm-hmm.
Do we know?
Yeah, I'd have to check and find out what the requirement is.
Thank you.
I'll check and give you my card and get back to you.
Thank you.
Well, let me just, I'll get you real quick. Let me give you my name and number.
Okay.
And for the stuff I can't answer, if you call me, I can hook you up with the right people. And my name is Jim Austin. It's AUSKN. My number is 518-473-4635. And that's in Albany. If you call me with a question, email is James_Austin, AUSKN, at DPS. State.ny.us.
Thank
you. Certainly.
And Jim, if I'm going to bring somebody else in from, who is it at your safety?
Well, I can't guarantee who he'll send, but Gavin Nicoletta. It's I got it right here, actually. Nicoletta is our director of gas safety. Now, I'm in the Office of Energy Efficiency and Environment. Gavin is in the Office of Electric, Gas, and Water.
Mm-hmm.
So, we do certification and compliance, but he's got gas safety in that office.
Okay.
So, it's a separate director, but we work with him all the time. If you give me or Jim Den a call, we can hook you up with him.
Well, if you can do that, you have my contact information, right? Because, you know, on the list of questions that I set up prior to this, you know, I had questioned what the design criteria were for gathering lines and our tracer wires and visual safety indicators. Things such as that required.
I got some answers to that.
All right, well, let's see what we.
What are the inspection criteria for gathering lines? This is from Gavin. The following with lines not falling within. Well, it's from 255.9F of our regulation, and all these regs the safety regs are 255. The pipeline shall be patrolled a minimum of every 2 years for washouts and other hazards, including check of area, population development change. The line shall be surveyed for leakage at least once every 5 years. The adequacy of overpressure protection devices shall be verified annually. What design criteria are used for gathering lines? And his answer to that is the design criteria can be found in Part 255.9, which is the reg. Well, no,
I understand.
The reg is on there. Are things like tracer wires... tracer wire is not required by regulations, but it's good practice. Safety indicator tape. No, it's just. Oh, I got that backwards. Tracer wire is required by regulation to make plastic pipe locatable. Safety indicator tape is not required, but good practice.
Okay.
And it said, note that steel pipe is required in the following conditions: 150 feet of an existing residence, within city limits of any city or incorporated village. Within a designated residential or commercial area, or subdivision, business, or shopping center. And probably the easiest way would just be to go to our regulation section and on the webpage and look up Part 255, because it's all spelled out right there.
What I find doing these groups is that, you know, going to page 255.9 is not something that
The regs are actually, I've read a lot of regulations that you really do need a law degree to get through, but these regs are actually fairly readable. If you want the information, it's there, and it's not written in secret legalese.
Okay.
It's fairly straightforward.
And it's not like reading through the spec on welding a pipeline or anything.
No. It may say you have to meet ASTM blank, but it doesn't. Yeah, it
doesn't make you read through it all. Peter,
just a quick question, and I know you referred us to the regulations. Would you know off the top of your head? You mentioned steel pipe within 150 feet of a residence. Is there a setback for residences on gathering lines?
I don't know, sir.
Is there a setback on high pressure lines?
Well, we really discourage big lines running through residential areas, but you know we try to keep them away from houses to the great extent possible. Quite often, an agreement is reached with the landowner and the pipeline company. The vast majority of these companies aren't transportation companies, therefore don't have eminent domain. Some do. The Laser is a transportation company, so they would have eminent domain, but they reach settlement with all their landowners. So quite often it's an agreement between the company and the landowner as to where they want the line.
I just was curious that in the case of eminent domain, where somebody has to do something against their will, there's no setback that says we won't put it any closer than this.
I apologize. Sorry, there may be, but I'm
no, no.
Just again, out of my depth.
Okay,
there.
In the regs.
Thanks.
Or not in the regs.
Hey, Jim, I was just going to ask you. I'm wondering if what the prevailing notion is at the PSC. Do you feel you folks are going to have to absorb staff cuts? I mean, you sound like you couldn't absorb them. Have you heard anything about that? I think there's some of us here that would like to see some growth, maybe, in terms of oversight.
On the way down here, there was a radio report saying the governor is talking 10,000 more jobs. I mean, so I can't say. I've got
10,000 more what?
Layoffs. We're about 20% under where we were in 1985. If Marsalis, if the moratorium on Marsalis were to lift, we deal with it. I'd move people from other areas, but we're stretched pretty thin now. I literally have two people for the whole state for compliance.
So we're talking about a major bottleneck.
Well, as I think my colleagues from NORNU will tell you, Norris will tell you, these guys are in the field. I mean, these guys are not unknown to people doing construction projects. They're out there. And they're not everywhere all the time. They're not at all the places I'd like them to be. But anyone doing business in the state knows John Struve. I mean, he shows up at these things in awkward times and... he's polite and professional, but his job is to make sure it's done correctly, and I believe he does.
And he expects a phone call if there is something unusual going on.
I can't speak to the whether we'll get more or not. I could tell you I could use more, but I will tell you that we'll get by with what we have. I've got good people.
I guess my main concern as a town supervisor is that if we're going to have gathering lines that are installed without any of this process, without necessarily being marked or flagged, installed at 2 to 4 feet, for instance, they may be operated at 100 less than 125 PSI, but if they're rated to 3,000, what is to stop the company from coming in a later date and upgrading that pipeline to a higher pressure line that's already in the ground? It's not going to be moved. That would be a concern for me, is that we could have a pipeline put into a lower standard, which at a later time would be used, which would have normally, if it was done that way in the first place, would have had to have meet A2 or A3 standards.
Well, I understand your concern. I can't say that we will catch everyone. I think we'll catch a good chunk of them. Sound engineering principles say that you build a line heavier than it and you intend to operate it.
Right.
So there's always cushion there. I think the vast majority of companies doing business in the state are ethical. And I think those that aren't probably figure out we'll catch them sooner or later. But I hear you, sir.
Okay. No, we'll keep track of it on the local level.
Can maybe I just have one other question. We haven't seen a lot of midstream companies in this area. In fact, we've not seen any midstream companies in this area. Can you differentiate a midstream company from a producing company?
There's basically three levels. You got the gathering lines, the midstream, and then the bulk transmission lines. There are companies that just deal in that middle phase. We refer to them as midstream companies. They tend to be trunk lines and bigger. They don't tend to be directly connected to wellheads.
Mm-hmm.
And as a rule, midstream companies tend to be subject to our regulations. They're not the smaller lines that sneak under.
Okay.
We do see some from time to time. I would say the vast majority of them are subject to Article 7.
I would expect to see more of them operating here over time.
If, you know, even if we don't see the moratorium on Marcellus on horizontal wells and fracking lifted, we're already seeing the wells in northern Pennsylvania trying to find market in New York City. So I think we are going to see lines, or companies looking to develop lines, just because of the fines, the sheer scale of the Marcellus play, even without New York. You know, the market is
New York.
Yeah, it's not North Central Pennsylvania.
Right. So with or without the moratorium being lifted, we can expect to see pipelines built and...
Well, certainly companies looking to develop
and
it.
Companies looking to develop that. But
there's a gentleman over here.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to follow up on the pipeline issue. I don't know if the same one that was in the paper in Alivo, that was
Millennium.
The pipeline that was...
Yes.
Okay.
That's a very large line. I mean, that's a line crossing all of New York.
I just wanted to make sure.
Sir? Here and then...
Really good discussion. Seems like a lot of the concerns are around these pipelines with less than 125.
Yeah, I'll be very honest with you, sir. I didn't realize the extent to which local government had this concern.
So I wonder, just to try to figure out what the scale of it is there a way to estimate, I mean, you know how many miles of pipeline you regulate, and then there is a supporting structure of unregulated pipeline that feeds into that. Through your experience, or perhaps the industry's experience, is there a ratio, perhaps, or so many feet of trunk?
If there is, I don't know.
I think, visually, you can see that there would be many more feet of feeder lines than trunk lines, sort of like a tree, right?
Yeah, capillaries versus veins, basically,
right.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to get an idea of how many miles of this, of the unregulated pipeline exists.
Sorry, I don't know. I'm sorry.
I've never seen any number addressing that, and I do try to
thinking about it mathematically. I don't even know if you could.
Right.
I do want to point out, I mean, you know, gas development is a very risky business. There's a lot of capital up front, and these companies are competing with each other, and how they develop the play is their strategy. It's and so it's not just I don't think they're holding their cards close to the vest just because they don't want people to know. I think they have a fiduciary responsibility to their board of directors and their shareholders I understand the concerns that people want to know where this stuff is, but I just want people to recognize that there's a lot of money at stake here, and these companies are risking a huge amount of money to develop these plays, and they don't want their competitors to know necessarily what they're doing. So...
Yeah, but safety generally is not in the cost-benefit ratio, cost-benefit equation.
Well, you know, I've heard a lot about the safety issues in Pennsylvania, and I can tell you New York holds these companies to an incredibly high standard compared to other states. I think any company doing business here would tell you that things we've required for years, Pennsylvania's grouting of lines on wells. I mean, we don't regulate well drillers, but things we've required for decades in New York, Pennsylvania is now just thinking about. And New York's a tough place to do business in, and there's a reason for that. It's because we hold safety very high. And I don't want to speak from the company or the work. We're a tough state to do business in.
Well, that contradicts what I've heard. We have several public forums on natural gas drilling, and we were very pleased to have Professor Tony Ingrafia from Cornell,
mm-hmm.
as well as Ron Bishop from Otsego. Next week, we're having one with two attorneys dealing with the rights of home rule by towns. But Tony Ingrafia, who is one of the inventors of the hydraulic fracking method, he indicated that New York was at the bottom of the barrel in terms of regulations, and that we have to really update and relook at these regulations, because many of them were written prior to these so-called new technologies.
Oh, well, sir, absolutely.
We really need a careful reevaluation.
I worked at DEC for 15 years, but I'm not representing DEC. But they did have a generic environmental impact statement to handle drilling, okay? And they recognized that GEIS did not include the new technology. This is going on 3 years ago. And they have not allowed a single horizontal high volume frack since,
right.
Recognizing that they needed to update their rules. And they've been working on it literally for 3 years now. And we've had a moratorium in the state recognizing
that. I understand all of that, but to characterize New York as being on top of these technologies, I think is a mischaracterization.
Well, I was speaking to what we require compared to what other states require, and I can tell you certainly on pipelines, we're probably one of the toughest states in the nation. And I can tell you from my experience at DEC that the things we require for well drilling historically on, say, the Trenton Black River play was much more stringent than was required in Pennsylvania.
Well,
we have a moratorium on horizontal wells until we update our standards to reflect your concerns.
I'm going to move this.
Sure. Steve, with all due respect to this topic, some of us might have to leave at 4 o'clock.
Right.
I do, and there's some other good stuff on your agenda. I just wondered if...
We are going to... I told Jim that we were going to let him go home early. That's why I put him on first, just because he has to go all the way back to Albany.
Folks, again, I really do appreciate the opportunity. I'll let Gavin know that you've got an awful lot of interest in gas safety. I heard really very loud and clear that there's a lot of concern about the stuff we don't regulate. I, as I said before, sir, I really didn't understand to what level the concern was.
I prefer to have you the expert instead of us having to be the experts.
Well, and I apologize. It's a very broad issue. There's an awful lot I don't know, and we were trying to figure out who to send down. But you have my name and number, and please feel free to call me. And I guess I'd like to just end by saying I just really do appreciate the effort you're all putting in to educate yourselves. I think we're going to see an awful lot more of this as the Marcellus play develops. We're pretty much sitting. I mean, every time I turn around, they're upgrading the recoverable yield from the Marcellus. We're at almost, 1,000 trillion cubic feet now of recoverable. It's mind-boggling what we're sitting on. And so I think it behooves us all to educate ourselves to the greatest extent possible, myself included. So, no, sorry, sir? I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
It's almost 3 years now.
The moratorium?
Yeah.
I know they closed.
July 2008.
Yeah,
it's been a while. I know they closed the public comment period, which had been extended twice. They closed it December of last year. Not this last December, the one before that.
You're talking about laying off 10,000 jobs possibly. Once they started drilling here, they put on more than 10,000.
Well, I think that there's, I'm going to speak for myself, but.
I would hope so.
You would hope so?
I speak for myself.
I think that there's legitimate reason to allow the DEC to come up with a good set of rules. To give certainty to the community and to give certainty to the industry. That's my personal feeling.
And it's your safety. Of the water supply, of people, of everything.
But I also believe the DEC is perfectly capable of doing that and of regulating the industry.
Sounds like Jim's got it under control.
And he's from actually PSC doing pipeline. And I will bring in Gavin Nicoletti perhaps next month in conjunction with
the gentleman from Chazen is going to speak on water issues. You know, I try to bring in, as I think all of you guys know, I try to bring in the people that regulate the industry and are familiar with how it operates.
Folks, I've got a bunch of pamphlets here. They're all the same thing. It's a summary of our certification process. It's for pipelines and electric transmission, but the pipeline process is all covered here. This, I don't think I have enough for everyone, but this is on our webpage. If you go to our webpage, this whole thing is there. But for anyone who wants them, do you want another? Or?
Can I have one?
Oh, sure.
If you want
to read
it here.
Oh, here you go, sir.
Thank you.
Steve, and I'll grab two.
I can share.
Thank you. Thank you.
We appreciate you coming.
We try. And thank you for not tying and feathering me.
No.
Wait till next
time. Yeah.
All the chicken farms in Chenango County went out of business 20 years ago, and our feather supply is.
Thank you. I have a couple quick questions before we move on to the next topic.
Yes.
Of the gas company of Nornu. Can I ask you guys something?
I'm sorry.
Thank you. A couple things that came up in discussion earlier. The first one has to do with maps and the availability of it. We've been talking now about towns becoming responsible for having to become interested in the pipelines within their towns, which are below the threshold of being supervised elsewhere. All right. There were issues raised about disaster and them not being available to the public and to towns because of federal requirements. What has been worked out of late? Does Matt Beckwith, our disaster coordinator and chief fire officer, does he have all of these maps, all of your collection line maps now?
As far as I'm aware, he does.
He does, and we'll be getting all
yeah,
new ones
that
are built.
You have to understand that we need to, you know, the year goes by and
of course. Yeah. But my question is then, are these things going to be available for towns? Currently, I understand they have not been. Has anything happened on that front?
Yes, we're working with actually the town of Smyrna. The only thing we're asking is a confidentiality agreement we'll sign. Basically, help out with the distribution of the map so we make sure that it doesn't run. That's all we ask. I showed the map. Hopefully, you have the pictures.
You
didn't show them.
You didn't see my little.
We're working with them.
Never go anywhere without us.
And just take pictures.
Okay, and second, thank you. That addresses
sure my character.
The other thing has to do with the relationship between gas itself and the plastic pipe, polyethylene of the plastic pipe. Obviously, there's been testing, so I'd just be curious to have you speak to the issue of long-term degradation because of the relationship of those two materials. Mm-hmm. Is there any, and what's been done in the way of
space? Not that I'm aware of. That's why the industry basically has gone to the plastic. It's just a great, and certain applications. Now here again, if you want a large volume of gas going through a pipe, you're going to need the extra strength of steel through the form. But as far as your lower gathering lines, things under the 125 pounds and so on, like I said, first off, they're easier to work with. Well, first off, you need to make sure that you can trace them. Mm-hmm. So you need to put the tracing wire in, you need to make sure you got the caution tape that everybody can follow that. But the ease and convenience of that pipe itself in the ground, when you may have, as I said, the earth shifting, you know, some water frost, and you know, the rest of the things that go with it, you don't have to worry about corrosion because it's not going to rust on you. There's a lot of benefits to the plastic. And then along with that, you can have, depending on the size, it comes up to rolls, we say, like 500 feet long. So you can take a roll of plastic and only have one weld at the end compared to steel pipe, whereas you might have a 45 or 50 foot joint, mm-hmm. and you have to weld it every 45 or 50 feet, which, you know, here again, depending on the application, you may have actually, you know, at least depending on what you're doing. Plastic is definitely been a good thing. It's like anything, like sluice pipes in town and roads and things. Compared to steel, I think everybody would agree that they're far superior. put in for.
My concern was for 20 years from now, when these things are still operating and been in the ground that period of time. Not so much the interaction with the ground, but with the actual gas itself.
The gas itself?
One wonders, you know, whether research has been done to address that time frame.
The ASTM accelerates, has tested where they've accelerated that, right?
Yes.
I think as I read that spec,
okay.
It's typical of, you know, it's like, I don't know, I forgot how they did it, but they ran a different chemical through it at temperature to look at the degradation of it, kind of like what you do with metal parts and salt spray to look at corrosion resistance of. And I'd have to go back and look at that, Rick, just at these specs. I mean, they're a joy to read, to tell you the truth.
Can I ask just one more thing? How many miles are we talking about of gathering line now in Chenango County?
Chenango County today? I would have to take a wild guess because I don't have the exact number.
Okay.
There's probably 50 miles. That's a guess. I get you the right answer. And the question that the gentleman asked about the, you know, rule of thumb compared to, you know, the gathering versus your trunk lines and stuff. I'm not sure that there is one that I'm aware of, but you are on the right track. There's more gathering lines, definitely, than there are transmission lines. Obviously, all those wells hooked together.
The thing with that is the spacing units and formation that you're developing in the field, and
yes,
all of those things come into play in that gathering line system. I'm going to get back just quickly to the agenda because we do have people that need to leave at 4. I'm willing to stay until 7 o'clock tonight if somebody brings me a sandwich, you know, since I skipped lunch. Where we stand, Albany legislative actions, I think the only issue I wanted to bring up was I saw a bill that was recently sponsored by Mr. Engelbright that basically banned the removal of any type of mineral or timber or gravel from a state park unless it was being used within that facility. I think that's a piece of legislation that is probably not well thought out. You know, from the timber management standpoint, it would mean that something like Bowman Lake would wind up having a forever wild tenor to it. Again, speaking for myself, I think if I were to want any kind of legislation in that direction, considering the way compulsory integration law works, I'd like to see that the revenue from any of those activities stay with the facility. It seems more reasonable to me. SGEIS status, I don't know if anyone here can address that. Supposedly at the American Association of Independent Geologists meeting in February in Syracuse, there is going to be an update. That's on their agenda, so I may be able to come back with some comments on that next month. Education and training, that was, you know, one of the original meetings, I think, that we reasons that we put together this group to meet was because education, we were going to deal with BOCES. BOCES covers all of the majority of the counties that are represented here. Scott Ives, Jennifer, myself, and a number of the people at BOCES have worked on this pretty steadily over the last 6 or 8 weeks. Scott and I went over on Friday, looked at the BOCES welding program, took over a copy of the API 1104 spec. BOCES does have the equipment to train people to weld the steel pipeline for the industry. They have the proper equipment. They're doing a lot of work to the AWS standard, which is the pipe and pressure vessel. It's very similar to the API 1104, and the BOCES instructor was going to review API 1104 over the weekend and see how he could incorporate that training into his program. I think that's valuable. We've had a number of discussions revolving around OSHA certification by BOCES because any construction going on now
requires the OSHA 10 and 30-hour courses, and the Norris needs that training to be done for their people. People that work on the well sites need that training, so you know it would be my preference to see that done at both these. We're discussing that. We're discussing having the students who come out of the BOCES heavy equipment program, ag program, have a certification in rough terrain forklift operation, probably have some more experience using winches, because when you get onto the well sites and the gas drilling where the gas industry works, they do a lot more winching than the, not winching, winching, than the average operator around here does, and I think those are all good things to be working on. Jennifer, do you want to add anything to that? Because you've been to most of those BOCES meetings.
No, thank you.
Okay. And we've been working, again, Scott and I and Jennifer been working with Morrisville, and I think Morrisville is kind of embracing this, the idea that we need to train people for the industry. There's going to be a couple of presentations, one here on the Norwich campus and one at the Morrisville campus over the next couple of months to judge interest in the student body. And certainly Dr. Milano from Morrisville is back here. He's been very supportive of my efforts and Scott's efforts. So any questions on what we're doing with that? Anyone want to throw in some help with us? Our support behind us on this. God, I don't even get support for these this work.
That's I, for one, I got to speak up. That's a very good move, guys.
Thank you.
Way to go.
So that's where that portion of it stands. I plan on continuing to work with Scott and with anyone who's interested and wants to help us with this. Commerce Shenango, I think most of you know that Commerce Shenango and I have been working on a directory of providers of goods and services that the industry can use. Jennifer has pretty much finished that. She sent me a copy the other day. I reviewed it, and I think I found one name that was misspelled and one that we probably should eliminate from the list and the new one we should add in. I'd encourage anyone here because we had thought that we were going to do this brochure as a multi-county effort. I think Otsego County and Madison County, somehow we got disconnected, and Jennifer and I want to pursue just Shenango County names. So if there's anyone here from Shenango County, please review that brochure, because we're going to update it. If you know people that fit into those categories, businesses that fit into those categories, let us know. There's no way that I can drive every back road in this county and identify every logger, every competent welder, even every fab shop. However, I will say that driving around Shenango County, I was duly impressed with the number of products that we manufacture here. It's interesting. I got down to a company way down below Afton and found that they manufacture all the park benches, all the waste baskets, and a lot of the installed artwork for all the parks in New York City, for all the parks in Boston, and the parks in Baltimore. And I talked to them the other day regarding some products for Green World for their new business, and now they're doing some work out in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. So it really is surprising to me to go out there and see what goes on in this county. And I guess with that conclusion, any comments from anyone?
Steve, where could they review this?
Jennifer?
I'm about to go into a round of printing with it, and I also have to, despite my efforts to turn it into a readable PDF file in the format that it's in to put it online, it's not going to work that way, so I need to scan it and upload it. I was planning on bringing copies to next month's meeting to distribute for everyone. And then again, as ongoing feedback, we'll probably be doing a big update once every 6 months or so, because every time I go to add say, four or five businesses to it, I then need to add four pages to it because it's based on a four-page format, you know, the printed version. So, or we can do a supplemental insert or something. But so I'll have a copy for everyone next month.
Can I scan
it? Of course,
that?
We'll be able to supply groups of, you know, however many copies individuals are interested in.
Scanning that, can I scan that for you? Do you want me to scan that?
We can do it.
I have a scanner that is brutally fast. I mean, I scan.
I can probably handle it. I'll let you know if I need help. And, you know, just so you know, also, these guys reviewed it again for me this week. Told me there were a couple businesses that they patronized that weren't in there. So we've, you know, got a couple more tweaks to it. But really, it's pretty much ready to go. So.
I'm sorry, Jennifer. I know this sounds like a very base question, but did your businesses pay to be on this, or is this part of the chamber? How did you do this?
The only people that paid are people who decided to purchase an advertisement, and we did have some people that wanted to purchase an advertisement. And then what we did was we gave old listings to chamber members, and then any other business is allowed to be in the directory. So we did not, you know, discriminate against anyone who was not a chamber member, but we did highlight the ones that are.
But it really is like a Don's directory. It's specific to the gas industry.
It's categorized with every single category that we could think of that they might need for, you know, a product or service while they're here working, basically. I don't know if it's not quite as comprehensive as Don's directory, but it's...
Yeah, the other way that can be used as a tool is categories that we did not find somebody in Chenango County that provided those goods and services. I'm out talking to people who are in similar businesses saying, here's an opportunity for you.
Yeah.
And Jennifer and I have talked about maybe doing a series at the Chamber in March and April where we invite business people in and kind of go over the requirements to work for the industry, the expectations, the insurance requirements, all of those issues, because in a lot of the calls that I made following up in the directory, a lot of our local people are not ready as a business. They're not ready to work for you guys. And you know, when I talk to a logger, he says, well, I don't have workman's comp, and I hire the first guy I find on the street corner. You guys can't hire that guy. You're at too high a risk.
Right.
So, you know, I'd like to do that, and then move on.
But it is specific to the chamber? Chamber members only?
No.
No, it's not. It's just, it's open.
It's an open directory.
Open directory.
Chamber members a bigger print.
Right.
That's what you said. We're not bigger.
In bold,
I hear you.
It's coming out of their budget. I have no issue with that.
Okay.
They're split.
It says here that the next regional meeting will be in February. Is that the Chenango, Chicago, Delaware, Madison?
That will be this meeting.
This meeting. So we're changing, because it used to be every 3 months, so we're going to have them monthly now?
I'm going to try to do this monthly for a few months at least. It seems that water quality issues are something that has come up, and there's a speaker from the Chasm Companies, who is Russell Urbana Mead, who is an expert in water, and he would like to come speak. I would like to bring the gentleman from the Gavin Nicoletti in, and I may try to do the two of them back to back in one meeting. And I guess what I'm finding is that there are so many questions that I'm trying to bring the people in that can cover it. If that makes sense to you guys.
Because I think that for the safety man, since there are so many questions about
he needs
the
2 hours.
I think he needs at least 2 hours, 3 or 4.
Well, I'm not strong enough to run the meeting for 3 or 4. If that's all right with everyone. Any other questions? Comments?
Good job.
Steve, I just want to point out, in terms of putting these things into perspective, which is where we really want to try and get to now, in terms of the natural gas gathering line safety issue, we do have, I'm guessing, tens of thousands of miles of natural gas gathering lines in the state right now. So I think that it would be possible to do some investigation through Cornell or some agency to get a relative feel for the safety of these lines in terms of accidents and leakage or other things. That, you know, there's a lot new that's happening, but the technology for the the gathered lines is, not greatly changed in recent years. Is that right, Steve? So, mm-hmm. And that's something that we have literally thousands of miles of pipeline that we can look at now for perspective on how great our risk is from these things.
I agree with you, Ken. The only thing
that's
I find
is... if you can find them, Ken.
What's that?
That's if you can find them.
Well, that's it. That the lack of ability to find them will be reflected in the risk. So, I mean, that's just, some information that will help us navigate the issue a little bit more clearly. So, anyway, I'm sorry, Steve.
No, that's fine. You know, from my perspective, I always like to look at industry best practices. I spent 30 years building airplane parts, and that's just about all I did. And if there is a best practice, I like to see it codified and implemented. And that's part of why I like to bring everybody together. If we get the safety guys from PSC down here and Norse Energy and some other representatives from some companies, and they say this is how we do it and this is the right way to do it, I would say codify it. Go to our legislators and say we should just do this. Cost you guys no more money. And one of the things I always hated in my business was when my customer would require me to do something because I was the 45-man shop, and tell the 5-man shop he didn't have to do it, and all of a sudden I've got an extra nickel apart because of, If I was a Norse Energy doing something right, I'd like to see my competitors have to do the same thing.
Can I make a statement about that?
Sure.
Just a quick comment. But okay, so what I'm hearing is industry best practices. I go to a lot of these meetings in a very large area, Pennsylvania and New York. And when I listen to the regulators and the legislators, the people in government, I hear pretty much the same thing almost universally, and that is we have to permit it, we have to regulate it, we have to use best practices. This is what I consistently hear over and over again. Now, there's two aspects about this that I want to bring up. Well, number one is that the whole idea of a representative democracy, a republic, which is what our government is supposed to be, as I understand it, is that the legislators, the regulators, the people in government are supposed to reflect the will of the people. And I hear a real disconnect right now between what the legislators and the regulators are talking and then what the people are saying. Real big disconnect in terms of the numbers of, like, for and against. And so the other thing is this idea of, it's a concept from science. It's called the precautionary principle. And what that says is, we talked about, industry best practices. Of course, the company, they want to maintain standing among other companies. They don't want to make a mistake that's going to cost their reputation. But in reality, what could happen is the company just, a little company winks into existence. It's a legal fiction. And then it winks out of existence, when a big mistake happens or doesn't. Like look at Cabot, they're still in operations, even though, look at what all they've done. So, but the point is that a little blip, okay, maybe it's going to cost them some profit. Maybe the market's going to take care of that to some degree. But in another hand, a little blip, a little mistake could cost hundreds of lives, thousands of lives, maybe more than that, because these toxic chemicals are toxic in parts per billion. So if that gets into an aquifer or a river, what I would like to hear more of when I hear these groups of regulators and legislators and government officials getting together is just the idea that maybe this activity does not need to be permitted. Deserves more caution, especially if the risk is so great.
Let me just make some comments. It's already permitted. Part of the reason that I've been doing this for 2 years is because the activity is occurring in my county, and I would like to see it done correctly, and I'd like to see people be informed about what is currently allowed to happen. I can only address the current structure. You're here as our guest, and I'm glad that you've asked these questions, but this is where I'm at, and where this group. I invite people who are on all sides of the debate. They're up, they're here, and they're heard.
So are you saying that you would commit to having somebody from one of these, say NIRAD or Shale Shock, to come in to give a presentation to this group? You would be open to that?
Just please.
Not today, but, I mean, you're going to have an ongoing series.
Yes, and I will decide who comes.
Well, sure, but I just heard that you might be open to hearing having all sides be represented, have a voice on this at this forum.
I'm sorry that Melissa left. I wanted to thank the Evening Sun for the series that they've been putting in. But I was a little puzzled in part two in the last paragraph, where I think there's one sentence that may have three contradictions in it, or maybe there are two sentences. I believe it was somebody who is cited as being from Norse Energy that tells us in the paragraph, discussing the problems with Cabot in Pennsylvania. Oh, they've had naturally occurring methane for many years there, stated Steve Kice, an engineer with Norse Energy. Now, this is how Melissa quotes it. But then he goes on to the next sentence after having said that methane has been there for years and that it had nothing to do with drilling. In the next sentence, he says, these early accidents are giving a black name to all of us. Well, he can't have it both ways. If it's an accident, then it's something that appeared newly in the water, and it contradicts the phrase right behind that. So there is a great need here for better communication, even though...
And better writing.
I wouldn't say that about her, but this is the quote that
I can't
see.
Because I'm going to feed her dinner.
And I'm grateful that Evening Sun is making this attempt to communicate reality to us. But, she's investigative reporter, so we'll keep our eye on all of these issues, and we'll be back, and thank you for having us.
Thank
Stan's still smiling.
That's what I tell him. This is what I tell
tonight.
The meeting is adjourned, and I'm not the chairman. This has no official status. That's why.
I wasn't going to say something on the line. I'd tell you my name is Kirk Schlag, but he was sitting over there.
I was the president of Farm Bureau of Oswego County. Nobody's concerned about the numerous gas lines around the area. 200 gallons of fuel oil out of a whole heating tank.
That's wrong. That's
my question. It's not the same.
I just pull my hair off. I don't know.